Whenever I think of ritual, I think of Rabbi Jerome Molino of Danbury, Connecticut. I've mentioned Rabbi Molino before. I met him in 1983, but his connection to our Unitarian Universalist movement goes back much further to 1935, when he was called as the first rabbi at the Reform Synagogue in Danbury. The minister of the first Universalist church at the time, the Reverend Harry Adams Hersey, was the only cleric in Danbury to reach out to the young rabbi and offer to switch pulpits. Jerome Molino retired and became emeritus rabbi in 1981, but he remained active in interfaith efforts until he died, 12 years ago. He remained, too, a friend of every UU minister who was lucky enough to serve with him in that same town, as I was in the mid-1980s. You Universalist Unitarians, as he always called us, because first it was a Universalist church, so then they joined with the Unitarians, so he always called us Universalist Unitarians. He said, "You Universalist Unitarians are a lot like us Reformed Jews. Same theology, same polity. You just don't have rituals." There's a lot of truth to that. But in fact, ritual is, we don't have formal, religiously kind of heavy rituals, but in fact, a ritual is any activity that a society or a group establishes to celebrate and renew commonly held perceptions. As Charles Hambrick Stowe, who's a prominent theologian in Chicago, has written, even seemingly anti-ritualists cannot live without ritual, and iconoclasts cannot live without images that give meaning to their lives. This is true for Universalist Unitarians, too. And indeed, our regular Sunday services have their ritual dimensions. Hymns, chalice lighting, joys and sorrows, music. Anyone who's been here before, any minister, rabbi, imam, anywhere, is designing a service, they need to include some continuity so that people kind of know what to expect a little bit, and some originality so it doesn't get too stiff, stale, and boring. Some left lobe stimulation, which here we have like the sermon, readings, announcements. Some right lobe stimulation, music, candles, periods of silence. What all young ministers discover. Just try to drop one of these things. No matter, people say, you talk to five people and they go, "Oh, nobody cares about that." Then try to drop it. And you'll find a bunch of people say, "What? How dare you?" But it's not just the worship. Try to drop coffee hour. You're in real trouble with that. Plus, almost all Unitarian Universalist groups have some intentionally designed and collectively enacted rituals here that are just totally iconoclastic to the group, and they're very popular. So the most obvious example I can think of here is the Go Now in Peace ending, which I immediately stopped. Not because I wasn't good, but just to help you see how iconic things can become. The flower communion. What do you have here that's pretty familiar and has maybe not iconic, but it's become ritualized and expected? The flower communion, the water communion. In November, you have a, next month, there's a bread communion. In December, there's a Christmas pageant. In June, there's a teacher's appreciation bridging ceremony. So there are a variety of things. As today's order of service makes clear, with the, you see these new categories, introspection, exploration, let's start over here, gathering, centering, affirming community, introspection, exploration, returning to the service of light. We've tried, and the reason I've added those is to try to add a little shape or suggest that a shape that is already there in our services, and by suggesting what the, just giving you a sense of the arc of the service that I'm aiming at. Notice the six stages, as I said, and it's what I'm trying to achieve every Sunday, gathering, centering, getting, you know, kind of shaking off the other concerns, recognizing what we're doing here. Oh, yeah, okay, we're a community, and here's who we are, and this is all this stuff about the, you know, the opening words, the light, the affirmation, oh, this is who we are, and this is what we're doing. That introspection, kind of go within, exploration, contemplate an idea, or as I'll explain next month and throughout, one of the things that I'm always trying to do, or our ministers try to hold up a value or an alleged value or an idea and ask out loud if this is worthy of our love. Okay, so that's exploration. And then returning to the service of life, taking, gathering what we've learned or struggled with or allowed ourselves to consider and or touched in our conscience, maybe very private, but then gathering up and taking that with us to help us go forward. One of the reasons I want to try going back to announcements at the beginning of the service is to support and not work against this flow. And anyway. Now, we talk about the flower communion, the water communion. This despite the fact that the word communion is emotionally packed for many Unitarians, as it was, by the way, for Ralph Waldo Emerson, and it's why he left the Unitarian ministry. And the reason it's so, it was packed for Emerson, and it's for many contemporary UUs, is its connection to the Eucharist of Christianity. This, which, of course, the bread communion is very connected to, too, and we'll attend to that next month. Well, because, though, of the emotional baggage on the communion service, the Unitarian Norbert Chapek who from Czechoslovakia and the originator of the flower communion and several hymns in our hymn book, he tried to imagine and work out and design new rituals unencumbered by emotional baggage carried over from the traditions that his members had left behind. And so that's where the flower communion came from. Now, as I mentioned last week, the first water communion, which we did 2 weeks ago, was held in November 1980 at a Women and Religion Continental Convocation in East Lansing, Michigan. And it was created by the archhymnist Carolyn McDade and celebrated UU lay leader Lucille Shook Longview, as a way for women who lived far apart to connect to the work each was doing locally, in Lucille Longview's words. The water communion has come to be used as an in-gathering, homecoming ritual for a majority of our Unitarian congregations today. And it only started in 1980. So what, that 34 years? But communion is not only a proper noun, communion. It's also a common noun, meaning intimacy or connection. Eating and drinking are parts of a universal experience. To exalt this common experience into a unifying ritual can be healing and restorative. especially during a transitional period in the congregation like the one you are all in the midst of, especially when some UUCF members may have felt bruised or wounded by the words and deeds of others in the community, especially at such times, sharing a ritual meal, banquet, or water ceremony can bring a community together, pointing the way to renewal and reconciliation. Feelings of dislocation aren't confined, by the way, to faith communities in the midst of transition. We are in the midst of tough times all across America, at least for many people. I've only been here 2 months, but it's clear we've all felt pain and anxiety as various members have lit candles for themselves or for their family members who are struggling. Likewise, many have lamented the agony we read about every day across the globe. Communion, as a common noun, intimacy and connection, is more a state of mind or state of heart than a rite, something we share when recognizing that there's violence everywhere, including in our own hearts. People agree to try to be a loving community anyway. Communion happens whenever we agree individually to leave shame and blame behind, or at least keep it at bay, that we might soar collectively. Covenants, like the affirmation you repeat every Sunday, loves the doctrine that we share, the quest for truth, its sacrament, and so on. Covenants like that can also help a lot in this process of becoming a collective, cohesive community, a beloved community. Good worship, including familiar rituals, can help a lot in that end, too. This makes me think of Rabbi Jerome Molino again. "We Jews have never abandoned ritual," he told me, "because it helps us remember the meaning of the 46th Psalm, 'Be still and know that I am God.'" In other words, rituals help us meditate, help us turn off our never-ending thoughts and inner chatter that we might experience our inner life. "Be still and know that I am God," Rabbi Molina went on, was one of his two favorite verses in the Torah. And I still recall he was a world authority on the prophets, and I talked him into leading an adult program on the prophets. And it was in that he shared with us this meditation. He had us be still. And he said, "Okay." And then he goes, "Be still and know that I am God." Just sit and listen to me for a second. It's Molina's. This is just a single verse in the Old Testament. "Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know." Be still. Be. Rituals help us by effectively preoccupying and thereby magically quieting our scheming critical consciousness in such a way that the intuitive and imaginative parts of our mind can bubble up and come into play. Unlike Rabbi Molino and most religious professionals, 9 out of 10, I did not come to this realization through any liturgical tradition, but through theater. I always liked theater. My family had season tickets to the Cleveland Playhouse, and I also acted in several plays as a youth. Then, during and immediately after my seminary years, I was part of an experimental theater company in Palo Alto and later Berkeley. In the summer of 1977, our theater company was putting up Euripides' Bacchae, and I remember reading Jane Ellen Harrison's Prolegomena to the Study of Greek Religion. Miss Harrison, as the poet Charles Olson always referred to her, Jane Ellen Harrison, applied then-contemporary archaeological discoveries, this is 100 years ago. This is the friend of Virginia Woolf and that whole, that crowd, the ritual school, they call them. And she would apply the then-current archaeological discoveries to an interpretation of Greek religion in a way that now everybody does. She described Greek tragedy as the universalization of what had been in earlier times cultic ritual. In other words, Aeschylus, Euripides, Sophocles essentially took the ancient rites of their forebears, the cultic material, and they put it on the stage. They made it what had been celebrated deep in a cave now was celebrated for everyone to see. Moreover, she explained, the archaeological evidence was very clear. You know, you can think of where I am as a proscenium arch, okay? That's when you go to theater, usually it's proscenium arch. But she revealed that in the Greek theater, the arch underneath it, archaeologically, they discovered was really a circle and a campfire underneath the stage. The ancient campfire and the ashes and all were still there, surrounded by a circle. Now, if we add to this our knowledge that the word religion comes from the Latin religio, meaning re-link, as in circling around a campfire, and I suddenly understood Greek drama as a means in ancient times and still today of bringing the ancient stories, that is the Greek myths and metaphors, to life. There's magic. There's always this magic in theater. Once you memorize your lines and your blocking, you can enter a realm of extraordinary freedom, a liminal experience that's hard to explain in words, but that somehow inspired and puts the actors and the audience on an imaginative, even redemptive threshold, if only briefly. Ritual is much the same. So, but when I talk about Bacchae, I was in this play, and I was in a theater company for 10 years, so all of us were pretty familiar with each other. And we were inspired by Polish Theater Lab, Jerzy Grotowski, probably nobody knows that. But this fairly radical exercise routine to try to get us in touch with kind of our primal inner being. And we've been doing this together for several years. Well, you become, there's a collective consciousness that you, when you're working with people like that, you get good at figuring where they're coming, there's collective identity. And then you're doing all these, we're a Greek chorus, you're singing the ritual prayers that the Dionysus, you know, the Maenads, the Dionysian followers of Dionysus had in their cult, and night after night you do it. And one night, and we were just at the Palo Alto Cultural Center, I remember, and Dionysius appeared. Now, say what you want. I mean, what is that? Collective imagination? I saw Dionysius. Everybody in the chorus saw. Many of the people there who were at the theater that night saw. Well, ritual is much the same, a means of calming participants' hyperactive monkey minds that we might bring celebrated myths and metaphors to life. In UU congregations, the metaphor we most often celebrate is the web of life, recognizing its horror, but also its power to heal and restore us. All life, wrote the mythologist Joseph Campbell, is monstrous, as it is forever feeding on itself. And it's true, all life feeds off life, the great chain of being. As life comes to fruition, that is to fulfillment as fruit, its sacrifice to feed and sustain the up-and-coming generation of life right behind it. Poet and farmer Wendell Berry laments that our culture has forgotten this principle on which it's actually based, the law of usufruct, the use of the fruit. People forget this, but it is still always true. We are tied to the earth and to one another, often violently. To live, writes Berry, we must daily break the body and shed the blood of creation. When we do this knowingly, lovingly, skillfully, and reverently, it is a sacrament. When we do it ignorantly, greedily, clumsily, destructively, it is a desecration. In such desecration, we condemn ourselves to spiritual and moral loneliness and others to want. Services like the Water Communion that the Worship Committee and I put together 2 weeks ago help us bond and reconcile with each other. Help us remember that we're part of something bigger and more sublime than our individual egos. And help keep us from scapegoating one another. The Flower Communion has the same effect. Indeed, all worship, well-conceived and well-ordered, works in this way, to turn off our constantly chattering monkey minds and connect us to patterns more basic, inner rhythms that restore and renew. In conclusion, the adjustments that I have made to the order of service, I assure you, are well-conceived and well-considered. I didn't just do it arbitrarily. And I will continue to tweak things as we go along. You know, if you struggle with it, fine. Come to the talk back later and tell me. I mean, I'm not as hard a guy as you might think. But allow yourselves to see how it feels. Go with it for a while. Let it sink in. Does it work in another way? Give it a try. Nothing is etched in stone. We are Unitarian, Universalist Unitarian. And as such, at least I hope, we are fluid and able to exercise our freedom. Well, let us hope so. And let us dare to do so and make that so. In that spirit, then let's go forward together, forward in the spirit of love and discovery and uplift. May it be so. Amen and namaste.